Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live on WI, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization. Hey, Reggie, are you hearing a feedback?
No, continue on.
Okay, sounds good. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 70,000 members nationwide, and New York DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500 members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. I'm Lee Zishi, and I use she, her pronouns. This summer, tens of thousands of New Yorkers experienced widespread blackouts caused by heat waves and strong storms. Southern California is seeing record-breaking heat, while wildfires scorch the American West, and the Gulf Coast communities are reeling yet again from another hurricane fueled by warming seas. Climate change is here, and despite both New York City and New York State having passed some of the most ambitious climate laws in the country, the fossil fuel industry has not yet given up on trying to build more fracked gas infrastructure in our city. Today, we'll be talking with Shay O'Reilly about the fight to stop NRG, one of the largest energy companies in America, from building a fracked gas power plant in Astoria, Queens. We'll also talk about how what's happening in Astoria is part of a larger struggle to not only get New York off of fossil fuels, but how we build an energy system that is different than the extractive, racist energy system that has been built under capitalism. So, Shay, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hey, I'm so happy that you are on RPM today. Welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so Shay is an organizer with the Sierra Club, and soon we're going to kind of dig into what the Astoria Power Plant is, you know, how communities are fighting back. But here on RPM, we really always like to have our listeners get to know our guests a little better and kind of hear about your journey into this work. How did you start working with on environmental issues? Let's get people to know you a little better.
Sure. So, hey, everybody. My name is Shay O'Reilly, pronouns he, him, his, and I'm an organizer for the Sierra Club. I always say that I kind of struggle to call myself an environmentalist, you know? So growing up, I really thought that environmentalism was for people who took a international vacation to Costa Rica, fell in love with the rainforest, you know, came back bursting with a desire to protect the planet. And that was just not my experience, right? So for me, you know, I grew up in a inner ring suburb of Washington, D.C., and the environment was a lot about the trees on my block, which went through gentrification when I was about 10 years old, and a lot about sort of the immediate surroundings that I had. And it was also about heating bills and other issues like that that my family sometimes struggled with. And so I didn't come to this out of some instinctive environmentalism. I actually came to it out of a concern for the rights of working people. And I started organizing on issues like immigration and economic justice. And then I was up in Vermont organizing with the Vermont Workers Center, shout out to a really amazing organization. And I started meeting folks who were telling me, look, yeah, my biggest issue isn't paid sick leave or universal health care. It's actually climate change. And it gave me a bit of a pause because these were people I empathized with. And who I really related to on a class basis. And they told me, yeah, we got wiped out during Superstorm Irene a couple of years before I came up there. And we really realized that climate change hits working people first and foremost, and that if we don't have a stable climate, we won't have anything else to build on. Even if we fight for years for economic justice, for universal health care, for everything that we want to see, a stable climate is the foundation of that. And so that was when I kind of woke up to it and I started paying more attention and got involved back in New York in a couple of local fights against gas pipelines, and then started working for the Sierra Club about 4 years ago. And so I really come at this work out of an understanding that climate change is a war of the rich against the poor, and that the solutions to climate change that we work to implement actually have the possibility to usher in a more just world for everybody.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk to you about that a little bit later in the show. And it's definitely a sentiment we have with a lot of our guests here on RPM as we face these fights in climate change and fossil fuel capital. But first, I want to talk to you about the Astoria NRG power plant. There was an article recently in Huffington Post, and it called it the hottest new energy fight in New York City. And, you know, I mean, as somebody who's been working to fight the North Brooklyn pipeline, which, you know, is only less than a year old of a fight, I'm a little bit offended that, you know, we're not the hot new fight anymore. But we have, you know, this company, NRG, proposing to build a frack gas peaker plant in Astoria. Can you kind of, let's start with that. You know, who is NRG and what is a frack gas peaker plant? And maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, the history that peaker plants have here in New York City.
Absolutely. So I want to start by saying that peaker plants have a really storied history here, and that you should really try to have on in the future somebody from the Peak Coalition, which is a coalition of environmental justice groups that have been working to fight peaker plants for decades, actually. And so I think that while this may seem like it's the hot new fight, it's actually a much older fight, and I want to give some respect to folks who have been at this for a lot longer than I have or that we have with Astoria. So I'll start by talking about peaker plants, and then we'll dig into NRG, I think that makes sense to me as kind of thinking about the components of our fossil fuel energy system. So a peaker plant is a plant that operates at times of peak demand. It's a generating facility, right? So it creates electricity. And peaker plants right now in the city run primarily off of oil and gas, and typically a combination of those fuels. They can switch between them depending on what's cheapest. And this plant in particular is a kerosene peaker plant. It's on the Astoria site, which is a big site with a lot of different generating stations on it, both peaking plants and what we call baseload generation plants. And those baseload plants run around the clock, but peaking plants only come online at certain times of day. So think the situation I always use to illustrate it is this, right? Think of a really hot summer day in New York City, and it's not a pandemic time, and so a lot of folks who work in offices all get home at around 6 p.m. or 6:30, 7, and you get home, you turn on your window AC unit, you turn on your TV, you turn on your computer. Maybe your kids got home from camp, and so all of a sudden you see this big spike in power usage because we also still have the lights on in all of our office buildings downtown, right? Like, those run around the clock. And as a consequence of that, we often have to fire up these really, really dirty generators, these peaking power plants, and they start really quickly, but they're also, because of their size, typically exempt from a lot of regulations around local pollution. And so a lot of these plants are really super nasty and filthy, and they generate a lot of local pollution like nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, and ozone. And as a consequence, they're really detrimental to the air quality in the community. They also pull in a lot of money. The Peak Coalition put out this really amazing report recently that looked at the costs that these plants are paid to stay online. They're called capacity payments, and what that means is that because it's deemed a general good, the ratepayers, you and I, all pay out large sums of money to these peaking plants to keep them on standby. So even though they're only running, say, 5% of the year or 9% of the year, we're actually paying them huge sums of money just to not run, just to be there waiting to pollute air and water. And that's what this is. And so what's happening in Astoria is that this company, NRG, owns this Astoria Gas Turbines facility. And this is a company that's based in Houston, Texas. They are a primarily fossil fuel company, but they also own a lot of nuclear stations And they also own a lot of subsidiaries, including Green Mountain Energy. So if you've ever seen them tabling at the farmer's market or something like that, being like, hey, switch your energy to go green, they're owned by NRG. And so they are, this power plant is actually subjected to a new regulation from the state that would force it to shut down because it exceeds emissions limits on nitrogen oxides. And NRG, being a capitalist corporation that wants to make a profit, is saying, hey, look, instead of shutting down or converting to renewable energy, we are going to repower, which means tear down their plant and build a new plant that runs off of fracked gas. And they're building this as a cleaner plant because it's cleaner than their current plant. But that plant is not allowed to keep operating, right? It's not like the choice is between this current plant and a new plant. The choice is between replacing this plant with renewables or replacing it with more fossil fuels and keeping us locked into that horrible pollution and climate pollution for decades to come. So in a nutshell, that's the fight. That's NRG. They're super shady. They have been involved in a lot of coal plants that we as the Sierra Club have fought over many years. And they are in it to make a profit and to keep profiting off of pollution.
Yeah. And so there are local groups and that have started to fight back against this power plant. Can you talk about why, you know, I know you touched a little bit on already some of the climate issues as well as the air pollution, but why do people not want this peaker plant in their neighborhood?
So I think it's really worth reckoning here with the fact that Astoria has a lot of these generators in their community, right? This Astoria station on the northern tip of Astoria, there are several different power plants that operate out of that. And as a consequence, they cause extreme amounts of local air pollution. And that's things like nitrogen oxides, like I mentioned before, which both contribute to asthma attacks and new research suggests actually contribute to the development of asthma in children. They also cause other long-term health complications. We've actually seen that particulate matter of the kind emitted by fossil fuel plants is significantly correlated with worse outcomes from COVID-19 infections. And Astoria is actually a really particular case because most of these peaker plants in New York City are located in communities of color, and Astoria is actually plurality white, unlike the other communities, but it's still a community that has this really, really heavy environmental burden. And so I'm not speaking for local residents. I don't live in Astoria, but I'm really happy to be organizing with a coalition of folks, including a lot of locals who are opposed to this power plant, who recognize that they want to see better air quality for them, for their families, for their neighbors, and that they also want to make sure that we're not contributing to the causes of climate change, right? So, you know, we've seen the Aurora Borealis, I think is the joke about the transformer that blew up. That's part of this general complex in this community that's been burdened with this pollution for way too long.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there's climate impacts as well. I know NRG and other companies want to say frack gas is clean. Can you talk about what some of the climate impacts of a plant like this could mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually haven't done a deep dive into the filings that NRG has submitted with their application. I think that some of that's actually going to come in their environmental impact statement that they're currently working on. So we don't have those data yet. But this is a classic case of greenwashing, right? For many, many years, the fracked gas industry has been arguing that they are a quote-unquote bridge fuel from coal into renewables. We know that this is BS. Like, this is a very old and tired talking point. And we actually know, based on studies that have been done by folks out of Cornell, that fracked gas contributes more to climate pollution on a 20-year time frame than coal does because of methane that is released throughout the cycle of the fracking process, the transportation process, and finally the combustion process. Unfortunately, up to this date, a lot of our inventories of greenhouse gas haven't included these life cycle emissions. They just include what's generated by combustion at the power plant. And so they're not taking into account all of these different ways in which the process of fracking for the production of electricity contributes to climate change. And really, basically, we know that we're in a climate emergency. We know that COVID-19 actually has only barely slowed the warming of our planet, and that we need to get off of fossil fuels as quickly as possible. We don't have decades to come for us to transition off. We need to make sure that we're switching to renewables really, really quickly. I really want to also do a shout out here to the fact that New York State has this really ambitious new climate law, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which I'm sure many of our listeners, and I know that at Sierra Club, we really worked hard to pass. This law mandates that we switch to renewable energy by 2040, and that we get to 70% greenhouse gas reductions from the electric sector by 2030. There's no room within this plan for the continued build-out of fracked gas infrastructure.
Yeah, and I really recommend people. Actually, we did a really great episode on the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act with Ryan Madden here on RPM. So I really recommend people check out our Simplecast for that past episode to learn more about that and the fight that went into passing that. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast apps. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about the fight to stop a frack gas power plant from being built in Astoria, Queens, by NRG. They're a large fossil fuel company. We're being joined by Shay O'Reilly, who's a organizer with the Sierra Club. We just kind of heard all of the nuts and bolts about this plant, why it's going to be really bad for the local community as well as our climate. So now that we know that this plant exists, how are people trying to stop it? What is the approval process like? And where are we at right now in that process?
Thanks for asking. So I'm going to try to distill it down. I apologize. I feel like our energy policy is actually intentionally complicated, right? Like, it's really obtuse and it's hard to get a foothold in as an everyday person. So I've spent 4 years trying to understand this and break it down since I started working at Sierra Club. So I'm going to do my best. And I hope that folks can follow along. And please ask me any questions if you feel like anything I say is unclear. So basically, this plant actually had all of its permits to be built back in 2009-2010. And this was under a piece of legislation called the State Environmental Quality Review Act, or SEQRA, S-E-Q-R-A. And under that act, there's this process for approving various projects that have environmental impacts that goes to the Department of Environmental Conservation. However, due to the fight that I think was actually led by frontline communities and environmental justice communities, there was a new legal structure implemented in 2011 that provides a different process for energy generating facilities to be approved. And that's called Article 10, right? So this plant was approved under the previous process, the SEQRA process, but it was never built. It was never built because the marketplace just wasn't, they couldn't make money off of it. It wasn't favorable market conditions. So they just let it sit there for a while. And then this new process was implemented. And so every other power plant that we have to fight, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit, is now going through Article 10. And then a couple of years ago, NRG said, hey, look, we think that the market's getting more favorable. We want to build this power plant. And do we need to change our application need to go through Article 10? Because we'd really prefer it didn't. And they had some upgrades to the plan since then, right? Like, they changed out the turbine kind and stuff like that. And so they applied to the state for exemption from Article 10 for being grandfathered into the SEQRA process, which is much less rigorous. And the states in 2019 said, yeah, you can just keep going through SEQRA, just modify your application and we're good. So they're still in a decade-old process of getting approval by the state to build this power plant, which is honestly a travesty. Like, the whole technology system has changed in the last 10 years. We've seen our environmental standards change in the last 10 years. We've seen the prevailing winds of climate policy change in the last 10 years. There's no reason that this plant should still be under this process from 10 years ago. So we've got to fight back against that. But here's how this process works. So they're currently involved in drafting up what's called an environmental impact study, which lays out all of the ways in which their plant is going to have an impact on the local community and the environment. Following that, the Department of Environmental Conservation will take a look at their application. There will be opportunity for public comment, and then they will make a decision on whether or not to allow the plant to go forward. So it's all in this one agency. There's really limited opportunities for public engagement. Many of our coalition partners, the local groups who are engaging with this process, have already filed comments on the initial environmental impact statement scope, which is like them saying, here's what we're going to study for this study, and then they're going to go ahead and do it later on. But that process, like I said, only has a couple more levers that we can push to really get the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, to deny this application, right? What we really need to see is we need to see that this plan is instead going to go through Article 10. And it's really straightforward why they should do this, right? Not only is this a decade-old plan, but it's also undergone several revisions since then, right? So not only is this plan really different now than it was in 2009 when they got their initial approval, it's actually really different now from the plan that they submitted to the state a couple years ago when they got grandfathered in. So they have a plan that's 2 degrees removed from their initial plan that got approved by the state, which to me means quite plausibly that it has to go through this new process, right? We can't be taking this, what's basically a new application, and putting it through a decade-old process. So we're working right now to really fight hard to get it switched over to this Article 10 process. And I know this is a lot of like numbers and names and all this stuff, so I really appreciate your listeners for bearing with me. But essentially what that would mean is that there would be a lot more opportunities for the public to engage. We actually get oversight through appointees by local assembly members and senators that would be going on the siting board that would be responsible for approving or denying this project. And it would have a lot more opportunities for the public to engage, which in my mind is not only good because we like more energy democracy, but it's also good because the COVID-19 pandemic has meant that opportunities for public engagement have been necessarily limited, right? People aren't gathering as much. We can't have these large public hearings. It's harder to go canvassing. We have to come up with these different creative solutions for boosting public turnout. And frankly, a couple of really arcane comment periods are not going to do it.
Thank you so much for breaking down that really wonky energy policy. You know, here on RPM, we're all about doing the work and organizing. And part of that work and organizing is often breaking down those processes, which exactly like you said, you know, they're not actually meant for public participation. You know, they're very bureaucratic. But energy is such an important thing that really touches, you know, all of our lives. We're paying for it every day. So really appreciate you breaking down that very wonky process for us. I spend a lot of my time also doing the same. So
I feel like it's a cottage industry at this point, right? Like it's so complicated both to benefit the big polluters and these big corporations, but also to benefit like the nonprofit industrial complex, right? Where we all like make a living as much as we do by interpreting this process for everyday community members. And if we had more straightforward regulatory processes, more democracy, like, I don't know, I always want to organize myself out of a job. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, but instead, like the combination of capitalism and the, you know, in the nonprofit industrial complex, like you pretty much have to hire somebody just to be like the acronym explainer, you know, like that's how we're creating jobs in this economy, doing this work sometimes. But so you talked about the Department of Environmental Conservation. You know, this is the agency that banned fracking in New York to a certain extent. They've also stopped other frack gas infrastructure projects before. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how New Yorkers have stopped these infrastructures, pipelines, power plants type things before? And also like what is it going to look like to organize to stop this, you know, just beyond participating in this regulatory process, that you so excellently explained?
Absolutely. So I think that one of the first things I really realized when I started getting into this energy work is that basically, I'm only exaggerating very slightly here, almost every single piece of fossil fuel infrastructure in this country is in violation of some regulation or another, right? Like, because we have these very arcane and bureaucratic regulatory processes and structures, there's a lot of wiggle room and a lot of things that happen in these various, you know, application processes and legal proceedings and all this stuff. And I think that if you actually looked into it, you would find a number of, you know, little like Al Capone on the tax stuff things going on. But that's not actually how we win, right? Like this whole system runs because a bunch of corporations have a lot more power over our energy system than we, the people, do. And I always talk about it like this, right? If we had a choice, none of us would choose to continue to get our energy from a system that poisons our air, that pollutes our water, that causes illness from the point of extraction to the point of combustion, and that imperils our future living on our fragile planet with its incredibly delicate climate structures, which we only are beginning to understand. What's happening instead is that we don't have that choice, right? What we instead have is a bunch of corporations and a bunch of Wall Street backers of those corporations that have tilted the system to their advantage and that have continued to profit off of our energy rates and off of the continued pollution to our planet. So what we have is a problem of democracy, right? Where we have this system that's set up to benefit these small minority interests, the wealthy. And the solution to that has to be more democracy. And we've seen this bear out in fights in New York State and in New York City over many years, right? Where we've actually been able to see the power of people coming together to demand our system, our public system, serve the public instead of these private interests. So I think a lot about the fight to ban fracking, which was actually before my time in the climate movement. So I'm deeply indebted to all the people who charted this path before me, where we banned, I want to be super clear about this, we banned the fracking process in New York State. We did not ban the transport and use of fracked gas, as I'm sure all of our listeners understand now, and as you understand so intimately. So what that means is that we've banned the process of fracking, and that wasn't just like an organic outcome, right? What happened was we have this juicy piece of Marcellus shale in the southern tier of New York especially, and fracking companies were very interested in moving into that area and starting to extract the fracked gas, the gas that was there, through the process of fracking. And what happened instead was that local community members came together and they demanded that the state stop this from happening. And that meant that people came together across urban areas and rural areas, whether their issue most immediately was pollution to their land and their air, because they live in these areas that were being threatened by fracking, or the climate pollution caused the fracking process was causing sea level rise and superstorms, whether they were farmers or other kinds of workers or small business owners or even some allies in the ownership class who all recognized that we have to ban this process here and we have to stop it now. And they organized a strategic campaign that upped the pressure on decision makers like Governor Cuomo over several years through various tactics like getting legislators on board, right? Getting that soft power that legislators have to represent their constituents, through bothering the governor wherever he went, right? Like rallying outside of his speeches at all of his public appearances, which we know he takes such pride in, through educating the public, getting different parts of our civil society on board, whether it be religious organizations or, you know, business owners or other people, just kind of all these different pillars of our society on board with the fight to ban fracking. And eventually what that caused was that the governor had so much pressure on him to ban fracking, he went ahead and did it, right? And this wasn't because he's a nice and beneficent person, but it's because he saw that his constituents were demanding it. And we're building the kind of power that he had to listen to. And I think that that's the model for these fights going forward. But we really have to make sure that when we're fighting these fights, we're actually raising up the voices of folks who are living at the front lines of this issue, who are right up against the fence line, right up in the neighborhood that's going to be most impacted, and by making sure that they're the ones who are calling the shots. So I think we're going to talk about Dan Scammer in a little bit, and I'll talk a little bit how that fight's playing out. But what it really looks like is waging these strategic campaigns that need everybody, but that especially need the folks who are living with these consequences right here and right now, leading the charge and building this movement that can exert power. And I want to be really clear here, right? The State Department of Environmental Conservation, the DEC, is headed by Cuomo appointees. Governor Cuomo is the one who has the power to stop this. And a lot of the fights about fracked gas infrastructure that, Lee, you've been a leader in, you know, y'all often, you know, call out Basil Sagos, the head of the DEC, right? But in the end, it's also about Governor Cuomo, stop this project, stop the Williams pipeline, you know, stop the Constitution pipeline. And that's because he has done a really good job at making sure that everything answers to him. And he has said that he wants to be a climate leader, and it's on us to actually make him do it, right? Again, politicians don't do things out of the goodness of the kindness of their heart. No offense to my politician friends. They do things because they see that the people that they are accountable to are demanding them, and that we can marshal the power, whether it comes as votes or as people in the streets or as various elected officials or cultural workers, that power is unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Cuomo definitely would not have banned fracking without people at his door. And, you know, even the CLCPA, you know, he actually put the word leadership in there. Yet here we are constantly having to, you know, actually hold him accountable to the own laws that, you know, he's signed. Is this plant actually like against New York City and New York State's climate laws that we have passed, you know, that Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio so often kind of point to as, you know, their climate leadership bona fides?
I think that that is a social movement question masquerading as a legal question, right? So we have these laws that have this language about how we need to get off of fossil fuels, but how that is actually implemented is up to us as the people of New York to force, right? Like, it's not necessarily that, you know, we're not going to get them on this one clause in this one paragraph of this one law unless we put pressure on the interpreters of that law in the state government to insist that that's the case, right? So right now, here's what NRG is saying. NRG is saying that they are going to repower this plant. They're going to build this new fracked gas plant to replace this kerosene plant. And that when 2040 comes, they can flip a switch and switch it over to hydrogen fuel. Now, all right, if you listen to their press releases on it, this may sound very cool, but I want to be very clear about this with everybody out there. This is a theoretical technology that as of yet cannot be sustainably generated on a scale to allow us to produce electricity from it. Right now, the options for using hydrogen power are primarily actually using it coming from methane, from fracked gas, and mixing it with gas from fracking as a quote-unquote cleaner fuel source. We do not have 100% renewable ways of producing hydrogen at the moment, and this company is arguing that they're just going to switch to it in 2040. In actuality, this is the argument that they're making, right? And the point I'm making here is that they are making the argument that they comply with the state's climate law because they have this hypothetical future potential clean energy technology that they can switch to. From my perspective, that's BS, right? Like, that's not an actual real answer to the urgent need to get off of fossil fuels. What we need instead is to switch to renewable energy. But there's nothing in the CLCPA that dictates specifically that you can't build a new fracked gas plant that claims it'll run on hydrogen in 20 years, right? Like, there's not that specific language. Where it matters is in the interpretation and the implementation of the language the CLCPA sets forward about where we have to go and what it's going to take to get there. And that implementation is a product of contestation, on one hand by organized money, as we see in the form of NRG, and on the other hand, by organized people, as in us and all the people who understand that we can't, I think that, like, that we can't keep, you know, building out this fracked gas infrastructure and claiming it's taking us somewhere, right? That it's this bridge to nowhere in actuality. So I hesitate to say that it is clearly and definitively against these pieces of legislation, because what we actually need to do is to make sure that this legislation bans stuff like this. And that's going to take people power. It's not going to take a bunch of lawyers sitting in a room, even though we have some amazing lawyers that we work with.
Yeah. And if people, if listeners are interested in learning more about, you know, the people power side of this, versus the NRG power plant side of it, local organizers and environmental groups, will be holding a teach-in, on the Astoria Energy Power Plant tomorrow night. It's a virtual teach-in, at 7 p.m. And there will also be a march and rally at Astoria Park on Saturday, September 12th at 2 p.m. And you can find out more info about both of those things at bit.ly/no plant signup. All lowercase, no plant signup. And so you've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting on 99.5 FM and streaming on all your favorite podcast apps. If you appreciate the kind of content, the conversation that we're having with Shay today, the kind of content that RPM brings you all the time. You know, we have been covering the fight for public power. We've been covering the fight against the North Brooklyn pipeline, a lot of these infrastructure fights, the Williams pipeline. And, you know, when you're seeing a lot of the coverage of what's happening in the world today, a lot of corporate media doesn't even mention climate change. But here on Revolutions Per Minute, on WBAI, you know, we're not only mentioning climate change in all of these fights and in everything that's happening, you know, we're also talking about how capitalism and the fossil fuel industry is directly responsible for that. So if you appreciate this kind of content, it's really, we're only on air because of listeners like you. So if you'd like to give to the station, you can call 516-620-3602. Again, that number is 516-620-3602. You can also go to WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy with Revolutions Per Minute so that we can continue to have, you know, great conversations with organizers like Shay and really bring you the stories from the front lines of the climate fight here in New York City. So again, please consider becoming a buddy for Revolutions Per Minute. We're only on the air because of people like you. So Shay, now that we've really dug into this power plant in Astoria, I kind of like to zoom out a little bit and look at the bigger picture here in New York. You know, this summer, again, you know, we had terrible blackouts last year. We saw blackouts again this summer. We have the corporate utilities like Con Ed and National Grid trying to raise our rates for more fossil fuel infrastructure like the North Brooklyn Pipeline, in addition to the Astoria peaker plant. There's another one in Gowanus being proposed. We've got these really massive frack gas power plants like the CPV in Cricket Valley upstate. There's another fight that you mentioned, the Danskammer frack gas power plant in the Hudson Valley being proposed. You know, that's a lot of frack gas infrastructure still being proposed in 2020, you know, as we're seeing the impacts of climate change in a state that's supposed to be leading. You know, why are we still fighting frack gas infrastructure this late in the game?
Well, there's a lot. It's a big picture, right? It's really messy. And I think before I get into why we're still seeing this frack gas issue, it is connected with the blackouts, but I want to be extremely clear that a lot of the blackouts that we've seen in New York City are a consequence of poor maintenance of the distribution lines. It's not actually we don't have enough power. It's just that they have, as I understand it, Con Ed and some of our other utilities have done a poor job of actually making the upgrades that they need in their system to successfully deliver the electricity that we do have to their customers. So I want to mention that. Because I think that there's this false idea that, you know, we can't keep the lights on with renewables, and that's just not true. But let's take a step back here. What we're looking at in New York State is a lot of discrepancy, as I think you were getting at, between the rhetoric that's being used and the sort of big ambitious goals that have been set both by New York State and New York City. And that's one hand. And then on the other hand, the continued reality that New York State and especially downstate New York, the Hudson Valley, New York City, and Long Island are heavily reliant on fracked gas to meet their energy needs. And that's a consequence. That's a question about, like, this is kind of our starting point, right? We sort of started with this heavily reliant on fossil fuels structure, and we've known for decades that that's a problem. But up to this point, we've actually failed to get the renewables built on the scale that would allow us to retire these plants. And that is a political failure, right? Like straight up. What that is, and there's a lot of kind of contributing factors to that failure. One of them is that up until now, we've actually had a really onerous and obnoxious process for citing renewables. It's actually the same Article 10 process, right, which we mentioned in the context of the Astoria plant, which is that we're hoping to put it in Article 10, where we hope we can make it die an ignominious death. Unfortunately, that's been happening to too many of our large-scale wind and solar projects, right? And currently, New York State has an energy system that was subject to deregulation, which means that no one entity can own generation, transmission, and distribution altogether. So what that means is that utilities can't own generation stations. Instead, generation stations, whether they be a wind farm or a fossil fuel power plant, are all owned by private developers. And as a consequence, the state needs to come up with systems by which they both incentivize the development of renewable energy, disincentivize the development of fossil fuel energy, and finally allow the siting or not siting of these various energy plants by these private developers. So we're running into this challenge where we've got these big goals, but the state is using what I think are kind of fundamentally very complex mechanisms to achieve them. And among other things, it had this problem with Article 10, right, where it's really hard to get anything through Article 10, especially wind and solar projects. And what that's meant is that we have been very slow in building out solar and wind projects that we need on the scale that we need to take New York State to more renewable sources of energy. The fear that I have when we look at this big picture is that it continues to be very hard to build these projects. And that's often very difficult because there is local opposition that is funded by powerful fossil fuel interests. We see this popping up in states across the country, actually, where the Koch brothers or other fossil fuel billionaires will invest in local, quote-unquote, grassroots groups that are people with second homes in these bucolic, you know, rural areas that are opposing wind turbines because they ruin what they want to see when they go out to their second homes. So my fear is that it continues to be very hard to build those large-scale renewable projects. The state looks for easy solutions, which look like importation of renewable energy from other places. That undermines a lot of the local base of support for renewable projects because we're not getting the jobs and the economic development that we need from the transition to a green economy, which leads the state to freak out that we're going to have reliability issues and continue to support the building of gas plants. And I think that this is the kind of vicious cycle that we really worry about when we step back and look at the big picture in New York State, which is like, how do we make sure that we're building big projects, that we're getting the investment in our local workforce and in our local communities that we need to bring into place this green economy, and that we're getting these fossil fuel plants not just made a little cleaner, but actually shut down for good with the communities around them being taken care of. And that's a really thorny problem, and it's a problem that requires a heavy public investment, and it requires big political solutions. It requires a willingness to overhaul how we site these large utility-scale renewable projects in ways that are good for local communities and that allow for local input without catering to minority interests and the wealthy who don't want to see wind turbines or solar farms. And it requires especially aggressiveness in being willing to engage in some big-scale public planning. I think we're just starting to see that beginning to happen, right? We've got the CLCPA, the Climate Action Council is working on its first scoping plan. They're just convening these advisory groups. They're supposed to come up with a plan for how we're going to meet our energy goals. But we can't wait until 2022 to start seeing that plan implemented, right? We need to actually get new renewable projects built now, and we need to get these fossil fuel projects shut down without kind of waiting for the blueprint for how we're going to get to 100%.
Yeah, and I mean, you're talking about some of the things that are kind of in the pipeline that are changing, but is there anything that, you know, you really see, you know, and maybe it's just like Article 10, like you mentioned, but that really needs to change in order for us to kind of build this at the scale we want? But also, as you're talking about, not just making sure we're replacing fossil fuels with renewables, but we're actually building an energy system that's based in energy democracy, not this, you know, very extractive racist system that we've seen. You know, what needs to change?
So first of all, we need siting reform, and the state is working on that. There's a new Office of Renewable Energy Siting that is being developed at the state level that's going to refine some of the processes for siting large-scale renewable projects. Secondly, I think that what we really need to see is an empowering of the public. And by the public, I don't just mean the most vocal people who show up to community board meetings, who often tend to have a lot of privilege, right? Because they're people who can get educated and show up to these meetings and take time out of their day to attend them. We need to see an empowered public that's actually able to engage in large-scale planning around the community vision that they have for their people. And I want to shout out a couple of really great organizations that are working on this, and I hope that maybe they'll come on RPM at some point. But I know that we're right now working closely in solidarity with Bros out of Sunset Park, Brooklyn, where they have recognized for many years, long before we did at Sierra Club, that their waterfront area was a really great site for offshore wind port development. Right. And so they're working to secure the funds that they need to have that be turned into a port that can provide local, good blue collar jobs for their community. And they're also working with the developer to do that. So what we want to see is that kind of empowered community. And they're actually in a huge fight right now over the rezoning of their area, and big solidarity to them. I hope that folks will contact the city council and let them know to oppose the industry city rezoning. But they're working to fight that and to implement their vision for their community. So we need to see a real investment in that. There are actually other states that provide large-scale intervener funds for local community groups to engage with some of these processes, whether it be land use decisions or energy use decisions, all that kind of stuff, which can allow groups that are historically marginalized and oppressed to actually engage with some of these processes, right? To be able to pay staff to take this on, to pay community members to show up to meetings, stuff like that. So that's another thing that could change. We need to see a broadening of democracy, and whether what that looks like is, you know, bigger implementation of community solar programs that have shared ownership, or whether it means some of the interesting innovations that are happening right now in exploring how we can do kind of the state helping to fund these large-scale energy projects. I know that the DSA has been thinking about that a lot with their public power campaign. And I'll say that, you know, Sierra Club, we're sort of agnostic on that right now. We kind of want to see it get built, whatever happens. But I think that we recognize, too, that this model that puts profit over our people and over our future isn't working. We need to fix that, too. And we need to really fix... I think we really need to make sure that we are making it easier for people to participate in these processes and making sure that we're empowering workers too, right? We need to make sure that this is a virtuous cycle. And so the vicious cycle I was talking about before, right? Where if we have these renewable energy projects being built with prevailing wage that are family sustaining jobs that have good benefits that are subject to project labor agreements, that improves the constituent base for supporting these projects, right? It means we have more folks in the union. That makes the union stronger. That helps the union to advocate more for renewable energy. That provides a counterbalance to the force of fossil capital. And so we need to make sure that we're building good jobs. That creates a virtuous cycle, builds up the public support for renewable energy. We need to make sure that we're building these projects right, that we are providing good community benefits. It's the inverse of what fossil fuel companies do, right, where they go into a community, they extract from it. We want to see these communities being aided and regenerated through renewable energy with local hiring, and especially with making sure that we're getting communities of color into the green energy economy, because right now I believe they're substantially being locked out of it, especially the better paying jobs in it. And we need to make sure that we are, I just always go back to like more democracy, right? Like, again, if we had a choice, we wouldn't be getting our energy in this way. And we have a bunch of other options for us.
Yeah. So, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, how not all renewable energy, just because it is made, you know, through the sun or the wind or water, does not necessarily make it part of this just transition. And so one of the places that New York City is looking to get more of their energy is from Canadian Hydro. Can you talk a little bit about why that's so problematic and how big solutions like that cannot be a part of what we're building in the future?
That's right. So a little bit of background here. New York City announced last year that it was planning to source power for government operations from Hydro-Québec, which is a state-owned Canadian hydropower company. And specifically, they want to bring it into New York City via a transmission cable that would run almost the whole length of the Hudson River, down from Lake Champlain and from Quebec and deliver this power into, I actually think it, they were planning to interconnect it into Astoria. Funny, but true. And this is being touted as a green solution. The problem with this is multifaceted. First of all, there's a really significant indigenous sovereignty issue here, where several indigenous communities in Quebec have expressed that these dams should be opposed because they have been built on their traditional territory. They have displaced these indigenous communities. They've made it impossible for them to continue their traditional lifestyles. And in many cases, they've also flooded the food chain with methyl mercury, which is caused through chemical processes that occur when you create a dam reservoir. And that has resulted in a strong prevalence of mercury poisoning among these people who still survive, in many cases, or supplement their diet on using traditional hunting and gathering ways. So there's an indigenous sovereignty issue where indigenous communities have opposed this power being used by other states in the Northeast. There is also an issue where this power directly displaces local jobs, right? If we're very basically, if we're getting 1,000 megawatts of power from Canadian Hydro, that's 1,000 megawatts we're not getting from offshore wind that we could build right here in New York City. It also means, fundamentally, there's a lot of concerns too that this power is by a company whose main interest is in making money, right? Even though it's a state-owned company, like we know that not all state-owned companies are good actors, that we actually need real democratic control. They really want to make a profit. And so they often operate in the international energy market by overselling and then kind of shifting energy around. So there's a lot of concerns about whether or not this would actually result in a real reduction of greenhouse gas emissions across the Northeast, or if they're just kind of shifting power around, you know, pumping 1,000 megawatts of Canadian hydropower down to New York City, which means that New Brunswick has to ramp up their coal and gas plants in order to make up for the power that they're not getting from Hydro-Quebec. So again, I could talk about this one for like really ages, but I think it's really important to take a look at all of these proposed solutions and to say, hey, look, is this the real only option that we have in front of us? And is it consonant with the values that we have of actually finally for once respecting indigenous nations, of investing in our local communities, of creating local jobs, and of reducing the impact that we have on the earth and the ways in which we exploit labor and the planet? And to me, Canadian Hydro doesn't meet that demand. And that's the case for any of our partners, too, who have been opposing this plan.
And yeah, I think we will definitely have to have you back on, or some other people, hopefully some of the indigenous people fighting this on RPM to continue to talk about this. We'll also definitely continue to cover what's happening with the Astoria plant. But before you go today, Shay, you know, you're somebody who's been involved in a lot of these fights. And, you know, as someone who also does this work, you know, it's pretty hard sometimes to keep fighting, you know, fight after fight. While the world around us is, you know, burning and people are really suffering. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you continue to do this work and just kind of, work through those moments and keep doing the work?
Yeah. So I'll start with a little like organizer answer, and then I'll get to a slightly bigger answer. And my little organizer answer is that, every person I see moving into their own leadership potential, makes like, just revitalizes me, right? Just like meeting somebody who knows that something is wrong but doesn't know that they could do anything about it, and helping them connect with people in their community and really be able to make their to make demands on the people who have power and to exert their own power. That is, I think, what will save us in the end, right? Like to see people coming into their own and claiming that their community demands something different. There is a seed of our of the future world that we all desperately need in every single one of those moments. But I'm also going to say, and I won't get too, I'm not going to preach here or to proselytize, but I'll say that like my faith also sustains me, right? I'm a Lutheran, I'm a Christian, I'm an adult convert to Christianity. Yes, I'm also queer. It's very complicated. It's actually not that complicated, but my faith really teaches me that the powers of death and evil are not the final answer in this world, that there is actually a conspiracy of hope that operates constantly in all of these moments where we win, or where we see people come into their own power, or where we find ways to support each other, or be kind to each other, in all of these ways, that is, these are signs of what we talk about as the kingdom of God coming into existence always and in the future. And so as a person of faith, that's where I get a lot of my power. I know a lot of my comrades are people of faith or just people who know that we're going to win, that there really isn't any other option. And I hope that we find ways to talk about what sustains us going forward.
Yeah, I would love to have you back on sometime to talk about, you know, religion and socialism. I think that's an episode I don't know if we've done yet here on RPM. So besides
the great religion socialism working group at DSA too, so you should have some of those folks on too.
We got to do it. We got to figure it out. So besides, there's this teach-in tomorrow. There's this march on Saturday. Is there other ways that folks can get involved in this fight?
Well, you can definitely email me. Shay, S-H-A-Y, period, O-Reilly, O-R-E-I-L-L-Y, at sierraclub.org. Or you can reach out to the DSA or Food and Water Watch. They're all kind of involved in our local coalition. And I don't know if we're going to have a website up and running, but I hope we will. So show up to these events. Reach out to me. I'd love to chat with you about how you can get involved.
Thank you so much, Shay, for being on. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, and we'll see you next week, New York City. Have a good day.
Decision,